Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. And today, we've got some topics that we're going to be discussing during this hour that I think you're going to find extremely interesting. The first one is going to be with alien or about alien abductions. And my guest today is Denise Stoner. She and her associate, Kathleen Mardin, put together a book, The Alien Abduction Files. Now, what they did with this book, they did a lot of research, but these are some very significant cases of the human-alien contact that actually has been recorded. And Denise has over 21 years of investigation into this area, and she has just been so involved with this. And I want to welcome to the show Denise Stoner. Denise, you are a woman with an unusual profession.
Yes, I am. And after working over 20 years with the federal government and now retired, I can give full time to this.
Denise, just those few words you said, after working for so many years for the government, you can give full time to this. But this was something you worked in on off hours. When you were working with the government, it wasn't regarding research into alien abductions, was it?
No, but I did work in a government research facility for the 12 years before I retired, first on a military base and then in a research facility. And they weren't really particularly fascinated that I was doing what I was doing on my off hours, but it didn't stop me.
Now, Denise, your association, you say it was serendipity that brought you together with Kathleen Mardin. Why was it serendipitous, and what was so significant in Kathleen's family life?
Well, it was very, very interesting, and we find that it still is fascinating and a little bit unusual, because I had begun to read some of her books, and then she began to email me, and we were just contacting each other back and forth. I began to ask her for some of her thoughts and ideas, as she lived in New Hampshire, and my dad was born in New Hampshire, so I had spent a lot of time there visiting relatives when I was young. I was born in Connecticut. Well, finally, not realizing it, she had moved to Florida, where I live, and I was holding meetings down here for abductees in private. Mm-hmm. She contacted me and asked if she could attend one of my meetings, and I agreed. And then she came to a couple of other meetings, and I spoke to her and invited her to lunch at my home, and she accepted. So we spent a long afternoon talking, and I decided it would be good to approach her and let her know that I was an abductee. So I mentioned just a couple of things. But during that afternoon, I mentioned the fact that my husband and I had spent some time living in a little town high in the mountains in Colorado called Gunnison. Mm-hmm. And I saw her eyes getting pretty big, and she said, "Gunnison, when, what years, what happened, how long were you there?" And I told her, not knowing why she was asking these questions, and she said, "Do you know where Crested Butte was at that time?" And I said, "Well, we lived right on the corner. There's only two streets, two main streets in Gunnison. One of them took us to Crested Butte, which now is a pretty well-known ski lodge and area where people go to ski in the winter. And at that time, if you drove down there in the winter time, it's still dead end. You can't get out unless you turn around and come back down to Gunnison, to the main road. But in the winter when we lived there, you would find the marquee of the movie theater sitting on top of several feet of snow. Well, She lived there and taught school at the same time we lived there, and we had an experience and a sighting, my husband's first, in broad daylight of a gold UFO that we watched for over 20 minutes. And what I found out while she was here for lunch was that she sighted the same UFO on the same day.
Amazing.
And just watched it, serendipitous, and stood and watched it while she was walking home after teaching school.
Now, Denise and her husband had also an abduction story where they were taken. Would you share her story?
Yes, the story of my husband and I.
Well, share yours. Share yours first, and then Denise.
Okay.
Because I
yes, it was in Colorado also, and for several years we lived outside Denver, but we had a camp up on a ranch on the Arkansas River, just outside a little town called Buena Vista, and we were packing in August one evening after work, and at that time I worked for the National Park Service. And so I loved the outdoors and the mountains, and we had a little mobile home up on the ranch. There were very few allowed there. My parents and a good friend were another that came from Colorado Springs and met us there, usually on Friday evenings, and we would stay the weekend. So in August of 1982, we packed the car and left, and we had to go up through Kenosha Pass, and there was a little stop area there where you could get out and stretch. We did that. And no more than 5 minutes, because I knew my mom was going to have dinner ready and a fire started. Mm-hmm. And so we got back in the car. And at the bottom of the pass, you could see a little town called Jefferson. And it actually divided the road. And it was sunlight. We wanted to get to the ranch before dark. And we knew that we could cross that valley. We had set the odometer because my husband wanted to check our gas mileage on the car. So we headed down, and I noticed just as we headed down off Kenosha Pass, two big bright lights out in the desert. It's a high desert valley, and I was watching. There's nothing there still, even today. There may be one ranch at the far end. And I couldn't figure out what could be reflecting that large, that huge out in the desert. When we headed down, we crossed through Jefferson, the tiny town, and then we were out into the desert, and there was nothing but huge snow barriers on either side of the road. They were wooden, and they would stop snow from blowing across the road at night in the high wind, and also huge, up to 5 or 6 feet tall, tumbleweed that would dry and break off at other times of the year. And at night, the truckers and cars that did come across the valley could cause an accident and be surprised in the dark because it's pitch dark that night. So we continued to drive, and as we crossed, we were talking about a little bit of everything. And these lights all of a sudden came towards us. I couldn't see anything attached to them. They were so bright. And all of a sudden, I realized they were coming towards our car. And then they were over the car, and I looked at my husband, and I said, "What are those? What's going on here? I don't understand." And he was frozen to the wheel. And he wasn't responding. He was staring straight ahead. And then I noticed the wheels of the car were scraping the road and moving sideways to the driver's side. And just as I realized that, I began to panic. I was afraid. And we moved upward over the top of the snow barriers and across the desert and moved pretty rapidly. I couldn't see anything but those big lights. There were no other cars on the road. As we got across the desert, I felt the car coming down onto the desert floor. And I was just terrified because I was the only one aware. And when we landed, everything blacked out. And I saw the lights coming. Just before that, I saw the...
Sorry, we're having some challenges here technologically. When we come back, we'll find out about the rest of the story with Denise Stoner. It has been my experience through the years to hear various stories that people have had regarding seeing UFOs or actually being abducted. And there was one gentleman, and right now his name is escaping me. I can see his face in my mind, and He passed away a number of years ago, but he was a military officer. And when he was in war action, I don't remember if it was Korea, where it was, he had a particular experience of his own. And then when he got back to the United States, and he was living here in the Pacific Northwest, he had had a series of experiences near Mount Rainier. And, of course, Mount Rainier has been known for UFO sightings for, oh, my goodness, for so very, very long. Now, we're waiting to get Denise Stoner back on the air. Something happened with a phone line where we were getting a very loud beeping signal. But many times, these experiences that people have, it's very difficult for them to even talk about it. For someone like Denise Stoner to have held these meetings with other people that have had experiences where they can feel safe about having conversation is very important. The book, The Alien Abduction Files, is quite a fascinating book because Kathleen Mardine is someone that has just been absolutely involved with this in a very, very big way. She co-authored the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Denise, thank you for coming back. I'm glad we're able to get a clear line again.
You're welcome. We thought it had something to do with what my phone is connected to, but we've had some very strange things happen. Kathleen also.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me at all.
No.
Now, let's go on with the rest of your story, because you had this experience where you felt the car being lifted, you went over the snow, you're being lowered down in the desert, and then you blacked out.
Yes.
What happened after that?
Well, it should have taken us about an hour and a half to get across that desert valley. It's called South Park Valley, and it's flat between the two mountain passes. When we came to, both of us seemed to come to at once. Instead of being just before 8 o'clock in the evening, it was pitch dark. Our headlights were on in the car. We were all the way across the valley on a pass called Trout Creek Pass. It took us a few minutes to figure that out. We were looking around. It's now 11 o'clock at night. It's very cold in the desert, even though it's summertime. And we were freezing cold because we'd had the windows down to let the mountain air in. And both of us are just terrified, disoriented, not sure exactly what was going on. And we decided to pull over because the car was moving. It was on the high mountain pass moving. And my husband gained control of the car. It wasn't moving very fast, but fast enough that we could have gone off the edge of the pass. So I asked my husband to pull over. He did. We began to talk about what had happened. And he said, I really don't know. I don't know anything. He didn't recall the car being lifted up. He didn't realize what had happened. He just felt fear. Mm-hmm. We checked the odometer, and it had not changed at all. Nothing had changed. So it was as if no mileage had occurred across that valley. So we headed on. We had about another 9 miles or so to go to the ranch. We pulled into the ranch only to find my mom, my dad, and our friend walking up towards the caretaker's house. They were going to ask to use the phone to call, you know, hospitals, doctors, police, fire departments to find out if we were in fact in the hospital somewhere or stopped on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. And no cell phone service back then. So if they hadn't found anything, my dad and friend were going to go out in their cars to drive the road that we were on, because there only was that one road. And we rolled down the window, and they said, where have you been? Because in 2 or 3 years, we had never been more than 10 minutes late. Mm-hmm. And our response was, we don't know. Mm-hmm. My dad and our friend worked in the aerospace industry. My dad had worked at Aerojet General. Both of the men worked at Command Sciences in Colorado Springs. So my dad was pretty accepting of strange things. He was often sent out to work in the desert in Nevada, and we never really knew what he did. So he just said, okay, and asked us a couple of other questions that we couldn't respond to. My mom, on the other hand, was a mom, and she wanted to know. No, you have to know. You were up to something. Tell me what went on. And, you know, she kept at it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was her prodding that caused me to start to have flashes and then dreams of these big heads, great big eyes, staring down at me, something prodding at my body. I had pain. I had fear of being left back in the desert, of something else occurring that put us back on the other road. So eventually I went to Dr. Romack, who helped me recall all that happened. However, when we left Colorado, Dr. Romack passed away. Mm-hmm. All of the tapes and the writing and recordings that we had done over a five-year period were all lost.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, every bit of it. He taught me methods of hypnosis. I worked with him on other cases, and everything that he had done was gone. His office, all of it. They destroyed what he had, and I then began to forget some of what we had worked on. And when I met Kathleen, we had to get all of that back, and she offered to work with me on some hypnosis to recall and redocument everything.
And that was that. A great deal of that is in your book, and this is something that people often, I know Betty and Barney Hill, it was very, very difficult for them.
Yes.
And Kathleen is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
And so she had more than just a common interest in this. This is something that she'd gone through. Now, what I found intriguing about you is that you, when you were a little girl, had an experience. And I know someone personally who, when they were little, they were living in Texas, that they stepped outside the back door of their house, and they're in a neighborhood, no big deal, and they saw a UFO in the early morning hours. You know how it is with little kids, they're just out up and early before mom and dad get up, this type of thing. And mm-hmm. She was out there and she saw it, and I'm one of the few people she's ever shared that with. And she just had a deep awareness of it, and it wasn't frightening to her, she was curious. But
yes.
They watched it move, and I think her brother saw it too. So
mm-hmm.
I, you know, there are stories that people share, and you had an experience when you were, what, 2.5 years old? Your mom was giving birth to a new baby.
My sister.
So, yes. So tell us what happened with that one.
Well, I was with my grandfather. He was taking care of me because everyone else in the house was gone. My grandmother worked managing a huge department store in Hartford, Connecticut. My mom was in the hospital giving birth to my sister. My dad was there with her. And that, I think, is why I had this recall. That's what brought back memories that young. But at the time, I didn't really realize what I was looking at. I thought I was looking out the window at Humpty Dumpty, this huge egg-shaped thing out the window in Hartford. And it was right over the telephone lines, just sitting right there, rocking back and forth slightly, hovering. And I was fascinated until my grandfather came through to check on me. I was standing on a sofa because I couldn't see, you know, outside, just standing mm-hmm. on the floor. And I had stood up and peeked through the blinds. When he came through, I said, "Who put Humpty Dumpty in the sky? That's a child's mind."
Sure.
He looked out, and I recall even today the fear on his face. He was really afraid. And he had fought in World War I. And I think anything unusual, they're going to question. He was protecting me. And he took my hand and he said, "Let's go read your story. We'll get you ready for bed."
Mm-hmm.
So he took me upstairs and I had a bath. He put me to bed. He went back downstairs. And my wallpaper was full of nursery rhyme characters. So I was looking around to see if I had Humpty Dumpty on the wallpaper. I did not. The next thing you know, a little character came through the doorway, and he was hooded, but I could see these great big eyes, huge eyes, and he was carrying some sort of instrument or light because it had a light on the tip. And he came up to the bed and put out his hand, his free hand, and I just automatically got up and went with him out through the door and into the hall. And I believe he might have touched the wallpaper with this tool, and we went right through the wallpaper. The next thing that I am aware of is I was in some sort of room that was all smooth. It looked like metal, and I don't have any recall other than being brought back to my bed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, except it was probably some sort of craft. Kathleen and I have not researched that. Childhood memory, it happened many, many times. I feel like I was learning. I was in some sort of teaching arena mm-hmm. for some reason. I don't know anything beyond that. My sister was taken after that. I watched her being floated out of her crib that was right next to mine. My parents thought she was, you know, a really, really little escape artist as a toddler. So my dad built the bed up with extra pieces of plywood, and I thought to myself, this isn't going to work. She's floating over the top. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't figure out how she was doing it when there was painted plywood smooth all the way to the ceiling. And except for an opening that my mom could get into, but it didn't matter. She still was taken. Mm-hmm. So when I got older, I had terrifying dreams and woke up. My parents bought their first new house, had it built in another town in Connecticut. And I would wake up in the middle of a park in the middle of the night. No one locked their doors. It was kind of a little Norman Rockwell town, and it's still like that now. Mm-hmm. So I'm now in the middle of grammar school. I'd wake up, and this tall figure would be standing there, and I would have something dripped on my shoulder, and I have no idea what that is. We haven't explored that either. And I would run, and he would chase me. And I would get to my doorstep. I don't know today if I was being returned. I suspect that I was. I suspect he might have been seeing me home safely. And I would run in the front door up the stairs to my bedroom and get into bed. And that occurred over and over again. And I would have a residue on my pajamas mm-hmm. from that.
Mm-hmm. And also, too, you were told at one point that there was something that went into the tear duct, and you were told that there was a tracking item, if I remember correctly. And this is something that people really sometimes will say, this is a Star Trek special. It's very difficult for people to wrap their minds around the fact that there is perhaps a more advanced intelligence that is observing us and just primarily, in many instances, focusing on people as children. Now, this started back, you're a mature woman today, this started back many, many years ago. And yes. I think that the interest in this is escalating because there are so many experiences that people are having today, more and more of them. It's not hidden. People are communicating and talking about this. And you have your groups in Florida that yes. get together. What would you say to someone that's listening to this show today that has had their own particular experience? They just don't want to talk to anybody about it. They're terrified. They feel like they're going to be made fun of. They're going to be considered loonier than a loony duck. What would you recommend to them? Who should they contact or go to? And I know we've got a plethora of reading material. So much of it is sensationalism. But your That's book, true. The Alien Abduction Files, is not that at all. It's very, very significantly factual. And your story is in here with all of its detail. What would you recommend for people?
Well, that book is a 3.5-year study that Kathleen and I did. There are several other cases in there, some that Kathleen did, a research study that we did, We're working on another one. They can go to my website, and that's Denise, M as in Margaret, Stoner.com. All of my information is in there. They can order the book through there if they want an autographed copy, or they can go to Amazon and order the book. That is one place they can go where they're going to get definite and true information after a long study. They can call me, make an appointment to call me. I will talk to them, and I will listen. That's what I'm for. I will listen. I will explain to them whether or not they are just having dream sequences, whether they're having some other kind of experience. I tell them the truth. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to make something up that isn't real. Because people sometimes watch these movies and say, oh, my gosh, maybe that's me. Maybe my dreams are because I'm being taken. It might not be. Mm-hmm. And I've done this for over 20 years, and now I'm working with Kathleen, so I'm willing to help.
Well, this book is absolutely a wonderful read. I'd recommend it highly if this is an area of interest to you. And it just shows that there's so much more going on that we're not even aware of. And Kathleen Mardoon is the other investigator who has a fascinating story to share as well, especially being related to Betty and Barney Hill. And the coincidences, if you will, or the synchronicity of Denise Stoner and Kathleen Mardoon getting together. It's really something. So check out Denise's website, denisemstoner.com, denisemstoner.com. Also, you can go to kathleen-mardoon.com, kathleen-mardoon.com. Denise, this book, The Alien Abduction Files, is absolutely fascinating, and I'm so glad you were able to spend some time with me today. I know that your life will continue to be a very unique and interesting one, and I appreciate your integrity and honesty with your own personal experiences. Thank you.
I thank you for having me.
It's been a delight. For those of you, again, if you'd like to check out The Alien Abduction Files, Startling Cases of Human-Alien Contact, some that have never been read about before, go to denisemstoner.com and find out more, because she is one of those people. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. More good things to share.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime, or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello and welcome back. Donna Sebo here, and we have a second guest today. And this topic is one that I'm sure you've heard the term bandied about more than once, Indigo Kids. Well, Maureen Dawn Healy has put together a publication regarding Indigo Kids, and we're going to find out what they are and why she defined them as indigo and why is this significant. Maureen Dawn Healy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your book, The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids, it seems like we always want to put tags on certain traits, personalities, whatever. As human beings, we like to have titles, names, tags. What is Indigo Kids? Why has that tag been put on them? And why is this significant? So I've got three questions for you.
Oh, I could be talking about this for hours, but I know it's a quick show. So
yes.
Indigo children are those kids who have a high level of sensitivity and also have a high level of intensity to them. In other words, they hold these two what seems to be opposing qualities that are high sensitivity and a high level of fierceness or angry energy, which needs to be channeled. So they have this high sensitivity and this high fierceness, and they also share a similar mindset, like a need for honesty and a need to feel, you know, equal to others and wanting to be partnered with. And that's really sort of an explanation of who they are. And the reason that we use the word indigo is because it comes from the metaphysical world that, you know, someone in the 1970s, Nancy Tate, was the first person to notice around these children and people are an indigo-colored aura connected to their energy center of intuition. So their primary intelligence is intuitive intelligence, although they have other intelligences, but that's why we call them indigo children.
Why
there was
is
another
this
question,
significant?
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Why is this significant? Why should we even care that indigo is around them? Is there what makes them stand out?
Well, I don't think you necessarily need to care that indigo's around them. The key piece of information is there's an umbrella full of sensitive children, and they're one type of sensitive children. And the reason I focus in on indigos is because these kids have a high level of sensitivity and a high level of fierceness. In other words, things can go really well really quickly, or things can go in a different direction. So they need to help their energy get managed and channeled and used for a greater good. So I just saw more and more kids coming into my office with challenges and issues. So for me, it was like, okay, I know how to help them, but more people are dealing with them that need information.
One of the comments that you bring out, because of the environment that we have today, it is so unlike an environment, let's say, that was around early 1900s, you had a big shift then. You then went into a shift that came around with World War I. That created a tremendous shift for a lot of people. Then we had World War II. That created another shift that was major. And in that shift, especially historically, women moved forward because of the older women moved forward. And the children that came through in that time were of a certain disposition. Then you had the 60s, 50s and 60s, where you had the favorite term is the hippies, the love children. And then you had the evolution through the 70s and 80s. And here we are in the 21st century, and we're in the year 2013. And the environment, when you look at the way the environments have changed, just since 1900, anybody studies history, it's almost as if we are at a point of confusion because you have a composite of generations that knew certain things, and now you've got children that are coming in that are so bright. They are picking up on mm-hmm. stuff so quickly. Not that the children before were not. They were. But it was a different environment for them. Today, mm-hmm. the kids are blasted with information from the very moment of birth. There's constant information being downloaded into them. And they have just accelerated. And so you have a mm-hmm. generation that knows about that a little bit. But here we are in this generation, and I think people just get lost. They go, what do I do? Because we're in this very fast-paced, traditional composite that is moving forward into a whole new environment. And at the same time, it can be very disruptive. And you have these children brought into your office. It must be quite a challenge to the parents. They must look like deer with their eyes just blinded with headlights lights. I mean, it's they must just absolutely be totally confused.
Some of them are, some of them aren't. Usually there's one parent that's tuned into a child. But I would say the key piece of information for me from the different generations really is that previous generations were very programmable, meaning their parents would say, hey, go to your room and, you know, do your homework, and kids would. Nowadays, kids refuse. They say, I will not. So there's just a different energy with these children that need to be worked with, which is why I wrote my first book, Growing Happy Kids, and why now I focus on the energetic keys to Indigo kids, because when you parent or raise them from an energetic perspective, things go much easier. And it's not all woo-woo. I give very practical tools for adults in this book.
All right, let's talk about the triggers, because I'm sure there's some people listening saying, you know, I've got some grandkids here. I really think I'd like to send them to the moon. What could I do? What are the triggers? I don't know if anybody doesn't feel that way one time or another, especially when they're around kids.
Right.
They just go, I don't know. Right. They really should be on Mars. The moon. Let's send them out to the Pleiadian group. Whatever. Let's get, you know, what are we going to do with them? So what are some of the triggers, and how can you work with those triggers?
Well, some of the triggers are, you know, you can see them intuitively, but it's, you know, they hate to be felt like someone lied to them, even if it's their perception of some unfairness or dishonesty. And they really also need, like, for example, a trigger is I had one mom, she was pouring Cheerios for her two kids, and one of the kids actually, it was like, oh, there's more Cheerios in her bowl than mine, and that was starting to get the daughter upset. So, I mean, they really have this deep need for fairness and equality and equanimity, and they also need to be partnered with to help with that. But another trigger would be, you know, in the olden days, authoritarian parenting worked, meaning, you know, do this because I said so. It wasn't fun. Nobody liked it, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And now it doesn't work. You know, kids need to have a voice and a choice and to be more involved and to have someone who partners with them. Not that you're not their parent or grandparent or teacher, but they need them to sort of say, okay, give them more information up front, help them understand why we're doing certain things. So there's a whole bunch of triggers, but those are two really big ones.
You bring up Michael Phelps in your book. And we are very much aware that this is a young man who has just accomplished a great deal, and especially as a Olympic swimmer. I mean, he just broke all kinds of records. In fact, in your book, you take 22 Olympic medals and currently is the most decorated Olympian on record. Now, when he was 10 years old, he was making records. So it's as if he was born to do this. This is just something that he came in with all the right equipment. Now, it didn't mean he didn't have to work. He did. But at the age of 10, the passion was there. But he also was diagnosed with ADHD. It makes me question why he would have even been diagnosed that. So what's the story behind Michael?
Well, the piece of information that's really important here is that Indigo children, they have high sensitivity, but they have a high level of intensity. And Michael has that intensity, that high level of energy, and that energy, which is, you know, he was ADHD, which often means attention dialed to a higher dimension. So he is imaginative and creative, and he just didn't fit into the regular model of schooling. But his parents said, okay, what are we going to do? We need a channel for his energy. And they happened upon something that he was extremely skilled in. Not every child Indigo is going to be a prodigy, but if you connect them to a channel for their energy, things can work out really well. And that's really important to know.
Mm-hmm. You talk about a little girl. Her name is Serenity. Her age 5. And I got so tickled with this story because she is like an old soul in this little body. She's 5 years old, and I can tell you from having been around 2.5 to 3-year-olds, and I've seen this because as a children's author, I've done storytelling and things like this. When you can sit and have a conversation with a 3-year-old, and this was happening back in the 90s, when you can do this, you know something is happening. And they're holding intelligent conversations. We're not talking about the blues. The bluebird is flying overhead stuff. We're having conversation. And some of you listening may say, oh, come on, get real. No, I'm really very much aware of this. And so this little girl, she's got a lot of energy. She gets in trouble at school because she talks all the time. And she's very, very gifted. And at five, she's reading, she's doing all this stuff, and she's bored out of her mind in school. How many kids are like this? They are so bored, and they're getting diagnosed with these labels that are not real. I mean, they're just, it's just amazing. But they are really absorbing and utilizing information at an incredible rate. So tell us about Serenity and what she did. I just love this story.
It's so good. It's so funny. You know, you'll have to jog my memory more because I had to change all my client names, so I don't remember Serenity per se. But I do know that, you know, these young kids, and I believe I know the client we're talking about, but she was called Bossy because these indigos are leaders. And I believe she was the one who created a website for her clothing design at such an early age with her mom. And it's just extraordinary that young kids can do that when they find that outlet, when they find their passion and they're supported by adults. Incredible things can happen. And it's not, like you're saying, it's not about age. It's really about giving kids an opportunity to develop their natural skills and talents that work for them. And that doesn't necessarily mean traditional school with just memorization and giving, you know, regurgitating facts back. It's really helping them use their intelligence and their creativity and their imagination to learn what's of interest to them. But of course, they need life skills as well. But when they do get connected to something they feel passionate about and they can develop their strengths into skills, you know, it's no stopping them. They can do extraordinary things here at an early age versus going down a route where they aren't very happy and then they have to change careers again, like most of us, and say, okay, this is what I really love. They can start from the get-go and really develop confidence and happiness and a place to put their skills.
Not only that, but I think that when a child displays certain abilities, when you can put that energy into a constructive environment that supports that direction and encourages them to learn disciplines, it's amazing how they will take off and do things that will just surprise everyone around them. I think of someone I know, young man that's just going off to college. He was writing his first novel at the age of 8. So you have these things, and people say, oh, well, that's just the exceptional child. No, 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 no. Many times children are displaying these capacities, and as adults, I think we have to learn how to pay attention and say, why not explore this or why not explore that? I do want, Maureen, for people, because I know we're just about out of time here, you have a website, growinghappykids.com, growinghappykids.com. where people can find out about various articles that you've written and more information on the energetic keys to Indigo Kids, your guide to raising and resonating with the children of today. You call them the new children, the children of today, because, boy, they're powerhouses. I've seen them, been around them. It's just amazing. Maureen Dawn Healy, thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. When we come back, we'll have more good things to share with you. Check out The Energetic Keys to Indigo Kids by Maureen Dawn Healy. Go to her website, growinghappykids.com. We're going to be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open if you'd like to chat with me. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Happy Halloween to all of you delightful souls out there. It is going to be a fun evening, and in our neighborhood for a few years, we didn't have many children, and it goes in cycles. The kids grow up, and then the families move away and all that kind of stuff. Well, by golly, we have started acquiring quite a few youngsters in our neighborhood, so we're going to have to be prepared for those trick-or-treaters, and the weather here in the Pacific Northwest is totally appropriate. It's gray, overcast. It's going to be sort of dark when they come out because, don't forget, daylight savings time is ending this weekend. So the clocks are going to be turned back an hour this weekend. So here in the northern area of the United States, it gets dark a lot earlier. And that we're just really looking forward to it. I wanted to share some whimsical information with you. When it comes to Halloween, what is your favorite Halloween icon? The jack-o'-lanterns? The vampires? Witches? Ghosts? Black cats? Well, yes, yes, yes. This was an evaluation survey that was done. I just love these things. I don't know how people have time for this stuff. But in the research, they found out this information, that if you have a love of jack-o'-lanterns, if you just absolutely adore them and you carve all of these pumpkins and put them out in front, you're a fun-loving person. That's right. You see, the image of a plump pumpkin is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Halloween. And chances are, you are just one of these social kid-perfect people. You just always enjoy the holiday. And whether you have a happy smile on your pumpkin or whatever, you just really enjoy the holiday. And you love giving parties. And then vampires. Oh, my goodness. They are such the hot item at this time. And if you are into that, ah, yes, the sensual romantic. Now, they say there's vampires as they are depicted today. They didn't always have this reputation. They change, you know, depending on what environment you're in. In our world today in the movies, there's sensitive anti-heroes who have come to symbolize the redemptive quality of love. Yes, well, we all know about the other side of the stuff, too, so that's okay. But anyway, that is the whimsical stuff they came up with. And again, you're a sensual romantic now if you love the image of the witch. You're a go-getter. Mm-hmm. Well, think of the witch. She's always got her broom, right? Off she goes. Well, you have all kinds of things that you can do. You are very adaptable, highly intuitive, and you're strong and fiercely independent. You love being different. That's right. You're strong in your own skin, and you're going to fly your own course. That's right. So put on that costume, get your broom out, and be ready to go tonight, because I think you're going to have a good time. Black cats, oh my goodness, I just think that they're gorgeous. You're a sophisticated seer. You know why? Because this beautiful animal, the cat was revered highly in ancient cultures, and serene, sophisticated. You observe, you're quiet about that observation, and you figure people out very quickly. They say that if the black cat is a symbol of Halloween that you really enjoy, you're boo-proof. Say that five times really fast. You are intuitive, too. And ghosts, well, you're deeply inquisitive. Now, the evaluation said that ghosts is really the purest symbol of Halloween because it points directly to the roots of the holiday, a celebration of the unknown and mysteries beyond life. Again, this holiday goes all the way back to the Celts. And I know there's a lot of people differing in opinion, but when you study history, We like certain things, and we carry them forward from different cultures. And it's just absolutely wonderful, I think. And if you love Casper the way I do, the friendly ghost, you want to know about different things. And ghosts and the story of ghosts capture your imagination tremendously, and you're always seeking answers to the biggest questions about life, death, and the enigmatic world that's in between. Ah, yes. I just wanted to share that little bit of trivia with you. By the way, if you wanted to make a note about the most haunted castles in the world, well, I don't know that they're the most haunted. That's probably an exaggeration on my part. But there's a Castle Bram in Transylvania. Yes, that's where Count Dracula is. Yes. And, boy, he really was a bad dude. If ever you want to read about someone that was a real creepy crawler, he's it. But there actually was a guy that was that way. And, of course, tales and different things evolved, myths through the years evolved. But he was one nasty character, and he lived during an exceptionally violent, violent time. And then there's Chillingham Castle in Great Britain, and it's centuries old. And if ever you have a chance to go to England, you'll find that this is considered a must-go-to on the most haunted list. And I don't know what's happened, but apparently a lot of people have had some interesting experiences. Now, why not go to Italy? Yes, the Italians, wonderful people. The Bardi Castle in Italy, it has a tragic love story. And they say you can see the apparitions of the lovers themselves. Then we're going to go to Germany, the Elz Castle in Germany. It's surrounded by a very, very, well, they describe it as a deep, dark forest, and they say it's haunted by medieval knights. And then the Edinburgh Castle in Scotland. Boy, it's 900 years old. Hard to believe. And, oh, it's got such an awful history in it. You know, it's got executions. They burned witches there, which really weren't witches. And all kinds of battles. Good grief. But this is what people like to find out about. They say there's restless spirits within these big walls. Ah, yes, and Margam Castle in Wales. Lots of haunted experiences on a special staircase in that one. So, by golly, if you're wanting to just really have some interesting experiences, check out different places in the world. Always the myths and stories are fascinating. And we humans do have a love of the unusual. This is Donna Sebo. Happy Halloween to all of you. Wherever you are, remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent evening. Be safe. Watch those kitties. Make sure they've got luminous stuff around and they're dressed up nice and warm if it's chilly where you are, which it is here. And have a wonderful time with them. I just think it's a great, great holiday to celebrate. Donna Sebo here. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.